Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is a republic if you can keep it, with former Democratic Party Chairman Mark Brewer and former Republican Party Executive Director Jeff Timmer.
I'm Jeff Timmer.
And I'm Mark Brewer. Welcome to the Law and Order GOP Crimes edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It.
Later in the podcast, we'll be joined by the senior Democrat in Michigan's congressional delegation, Representative Dan Kildee. And Mark, as you said in the open, Republicans are facing the prospects of criminal investigations that continue to grow in the last few days. There's the seizure or the exercising the search warrant at Mar-a-Lago that the FBI did. And in Michigan, some startling new developments in a longstanding criminal investigation regarding tampering with voting machines. And let's start with that. You know, one current state representative and one would-be Republican Attorney General are among the nine Republicans who are now prospective targets of a special prosecutor investigation. Fill our listeners in on the details and the legal implications, and then we can talk about the political implications.
Sure, Jeff. So this all started back in February when, based on various reports, the Secretary of State, Johnson Benson, had been hearing about illegal access to voting tabulators. She asked the Department of Attorney General and the state police to investigate these access issues. At the beginning, it was just in Roscommon County, Michigan. But as the investigation unfolded, it turned out that there were several other townships in Berry County and Meraki County as well, where the clerks had been asked and had given access to these tabulators, which are extremely sensitive. They have to be kept with great integrity. They're supposed to be locked up. Nobody's supposed to have access to them. Where these local clerks had given access to these tabulators. So an investigation was launched, and it turned out that in the course of this, there are a variety of people involved. Matt DiPerno was apparently present at least one of the, quote, examinations of these machines, which occurred in some hotel room in Oakland County. Kraken attorney, who's been sanctioned, by the way, for her behavior in 2020, Lambert Gentia is involved, as is Dare Rendon, who is a state representative from Northwest Michigan. The other of the nine, Jeff, are a variety of people who have been, quote unquote, experts in the litigation that DiPerno has launched, and other people who have been associated with these, quote unquote, investigations, including, I might add, the sheriff in Berry County, Darleaf, is also implicated in all this. So they did their investigation, talked to these clerks and other kinds of things. Investigation is complete. The evidence has been gathered. And this is the point at which a prosecutor or the attorney general would make a decision about whether to charge any of these folks with a crime. And they're very serious crimes here. You know, tampering with government property. There are election crimes associated specifically with these tabulators, et cetera, et cetera. Some of which are felonies. So these are very serious crimes. But obviously our attorney general has a conflict of interest because DiPerno is the presumptive candidate for attorney general. So she did the right thing this week and filed a petition with a statewide group. It's a group that coordinates prosecutors in the state, asking for the appointment of a special prosecutor. And the initial decision that person would make would be whether to prosecute, and if so, whom. So no prosecution decision has been made. And again, kudos to Dana Nessel, who did the right thing by recusing herself at this point after the investigation is over. So that's where it sits. It could take weeks, frankly, for an appointment to be made. And I think there are obviously political complications there. We elect prosecutors on a partisan basis in this state. This is a matter which could take some resources. So this is not probably something that a small prosecutor's office could handle. And the way this works is the Attorney General's office would pay some of the costs of this, but not the personnel costs. And that's where it could be a real burden on a small prosecutor's office. So it could be a while before we know who is appointed to do this.
Two things I want to point out on this, especially for reporters who are listening to this, and people who are covering politics in Michigan. One, the Republican talking point and the DiPerno talking point that this is politically charged, the fact that Dana Nessel recused herself and turned this over and did so during the election is somehow politically charged. I would argue to say, look at when she did it. She did it in advance of the official nominating convention, while the Republicans could still conceivably, technically nominate somebody other than Matt DiPerno. Now, it's very difficult for them to do that according to their rules, but they're going to go into that nominating position eyes wide open. And so I would argue that this is the facts are what they are. The fact that he committed arguably committed crimes, if that's where the facts lead, that's what they are. The fact that they're running for office doesn't get them some special immunity from prosecution. So if a special prosecutor thinks there are charges warranted here, that's up to them. Nessel did the right thing ethically with her office. I think she did the smart thing politically, which is doing it before we get too close to the November election, before the official nominating convention. So I think that's point number one. The second point is, I said it would be very difficult, almost impossible procedurally for the Republicans to remove or nominate somebody other than Matt DiPerno for the office. And I would make the argument that at least among convention delegates, that this makes his position stronger. The Republicans love themselves a good martyr right now. But there's also a history in the Michigan Republican Party when Ron Weiser is chair that he will use cash to fix election convention problems. Smart Republican consultants and practitioners, and I would include Ron Weiser among these, recognize that it's almost like kryptonite for the Republicans to go into the fall with Matt DiPerno as their attorney general nominee. So watch for the prospect of money to change hands. The only thing that's going to get Matt DiPerno off of the ticket is Matt DiPerno. And the only thing that's going to get Matt DiPerno off of the ticket would be something better. So that's I would ask those questions. There was no, I know that there was mediation, and the Weiser had to pay a fine related to the Stan Grott 2018, $200,000. But money fixes a lot of problems. There's nothing that would prevent him in that settlement from doing it again.
Right. No, good points, Jeff, and I agree with all of them. Let me just add to this. I think the Attorney General paid perfectly appropriately here. Look, there have been no leaks during the course of the investigation. There were some press reports, but that was from the reporters talking to these clerks. There were no leaks out of the Attorney General's department, no leaks by the state police. They were conducting an investigation completely appropriately. And now is the time when a charging decision would be made, right? When the investigation's over. That's the way this works. I think it would have been inappropriate for the Attorney General to wait to make a decision, because that, I think, could be perceived as political. And finally, though, Jeff, she's been completely transparent about this. The petition for the appointment of a special prosecutor is publicly available. It's been widely available to the press. It's been reported. And on top of that, her office sent a letter to Benson that summarized their findings to alert the Secretary of State that, you may need to remind your local clerks, they're not supposed to be turning stuff over, election material and tabulators, to anybody who shows up and claims they're running an investigation that they may be associated with the police. So there's been complete transparency here, more than I think is actually required. And I think the Attorney General's gone out of her way to do the ethical thing here. All of this by DiPerno and his supporters is an attempt to distract from the very serious misbehavior that has been uncovered by this investigation. This is unprecedented. For anybody to do this, let alone people with public responsibilities like the Berry County Sheriff and a presumptive candidate for Attorney General. This is unprecedented. historic in a very bad way. But I see nothing to criticize here in terms of behavior of the Attorney General or her department.
Well, DiPerno is behaving almost exactly like Donald Trump in the wake of the exercising of the search warrant for Mar-a-Lago. The Republican talking point and the Republican modus operandi seems to be the laws apply to other people, not to us. You know, the fact that, you know, I love watching Republican Twitter this week. These people out there, Elise Stefanik, all these other Republicans saying, you know, if the FBI can do this to a former president, just think they could do it to us too, which is precisely the freaking point of American, you know, our democratic republic, that no one stands above the law. We're all equal before the law in principle. It would be a dereliction of duty if there is evidence of crimes that the prosecutors don't follow that evidence because of who the person is. In the case of Donald Trump, the fact that you were president, that you might again run for president, does not give you some kind of force field against implications for crimes you may have committed. You know, you fuck around, you find out. That's something I've been fond of saying on Twitter. And you have to imagine, and I know there's a lot of people who are dissecting the ins and outs of this action by the Department of Justice, but you have to imagine that in order before they proceeded, this was not a low level decision. This was not made by a special agent in charge of a field office. This is signed off on at the highest levels because the evidence, the likelihood of a crime and that evidence being at Mar-a-Lago and that crime being serious enough to warrant this unprecedented action. They knew it was going to be the first time a former president had ever faced anything like this. They knew the blowback they were going to be getting, and you have to think that they were prepared. And what we don't know about this search warrant is going to answer a lot of those questions eventually. Donald Trump could clear up all of this mystery if he wanted to make the contents of the search warrant public. He hasn't, you know, so all of this right now is fueling very disturbing rhetoric from the right wing ecosphere, calls to arms, threats of civil war, threats of violence. And that's been something that we've talked about a lot and has been talked about a lot by others, is the normalization of the abnormal, the rise of violence and the prospect of violence around our politics. It's growing. It's not decreasing. That threat remains very strong for this election year. It remains even stronger going into 2024. I think it's something that should concern us all.
Well, I agree, Jeff. I agree that the Department of Justice, the federal Department of Justice, has handled the matter regarding Mar-a-Lago properly. I mean, our listeners should know that the Department of Justice had to take a detailed affidavit of what they knew and why they thought there was probable cause that a crime had been committed. They had to take that to a federal judge in order to get that search warrant. And it had that search warrant has to describe in particular what they were looking for, how the search would be restricted, et cetera. And unfortunately, now I understand that that federal judge's identity has become public. No surprise there. But he has been threatened along the same lines that you described, Jeff. Jeff, I think you and I both remember the infamous Pat Buchanan speech at the 92 Republican National Convention, where he called upon people to ride to the sound of the guns. And everybody thought that was extraordinary, that he would use that metaphor on a national television and a national convention. Boy, has that gotten normalized since then, because now we have the very threats that you describe, and it's almost become routine. I would also add, though, here, I think politically, if I could go back to the point you made earlier about the Republicans here now being on notice about DiPerno, from what I've seen this week, this has actually caused a surge in support for him because of all this paranoia about, oh, it's the deep state and they're out to get Nestle's political enemies, all that stuff, that I think, Jeff, far from causing the Republican grassroots to have second thoughts about DiPerno, this may in fact cause a lot of them to double down on DiPerno because they think he's a martyr. Again, playing the Trump card, like you pointed out.
Agree. And so I think that the Republicans are going into the fall election with three people at the top of the ticket who are so far outside the historic mainstream of Republican candidates, with Tudor Dixon, Christina Caramo, and Matt DiPernell leading the way for the GOP. We've got, crazy, corrupt, and kook at the top of the ticket. And so I'll leave it to listeners to figure out who's who.
Well, and we'll see what the next couple of weeks bring. I don't know if our listeners are aware, there's a huge fight going on inside the Republican Party in Macomb County, which is one of the bigger Republican parties in the state. It's the third biggest county in the state. The original chair, who was as MAGA as they could get, was tossed out in the run-up to the April endorsement convention, and replaced this week. A Macomb County judge said no, he's to be reinstated. And so now, in the next, I think it's tomorrow, Thursday, they're going to be dueling conventions in Macomb County, one in the north by the MAGA chair and one in Warren by the non-MAGA chair, who the Republican Party, the state Republican Party, has recognized. This could have enormous implications for what happens at the state convention in a couple of weeks, because that's a big delegation, as you know, that comes out of Macomb. And if they have some fights, for example, over Tudor Dixon's running mate, the result of this internal strife in Macomb County could have a huge impact on what happens. It may even lead to more strife. Challenges to the legitimacy of the convention, challenges to the legitimacy of particular nominations. So there's lots of problems inside your former party, and nobody seems to be able to kind of put a lid on it and prevent it from happening. And it just looks like it's spiraling downward, Jeff, and getting worse.
Yep. And just to clarify, the fight in Macomb County isn't between the MAGA Donald Trump forces and the non-Donald Trump forces.
Good point.
This is between one faction of batshit crazy MAGAs and another faction of batshit crazy MAGAs. It's like in the Monty Python Life of Brian. You've got the Judean People's Front and the People's Front of Judea, and they're the only ones who can tell the difference between the two.
I like to say the Bensheviks and the Bolsheviks, Jeff.
There's another good example.
Or the Trotskyites. It's a battle between factions which are virtually identical ideologically, and they're down this rabbit hole. So we'll see how that plays out as well. That's going to add to the drama. Boy, I tell you, Jeff, I would give pretty much anything to be able to get into that Republican convention in 2 weeks.
Well, I would like to watch it. I'm glad I have certainly nothing to do with it. I can only imagine the amount of consternation and heartburn it is causing those people involved with the planning of the convention. It is the prospect of nominating a candidate for lieutenant governor is much more difficult and tricky than one might think. Gone are the days where a nominee for governor can just handpick their candidate and everyone at the convention is going to wildly cheer whoever that is, because there's a kumbaya spirit that comes together after a primary. These convention delegates are, they've got their bloodlust up. They're longing for red meat. They do not want quote unquote establishment pick, thrust upon them, forced upon them, that they're expected to then hold their nose and vote for. So the names that have been talked about in some of the articles that have been clearly leaked by trial balloons by the Dixon campaign, former congressman, former Senate Majority Leader Mike Bishop, as establishment as you can get. I can't imagine the convention delegates being cool with a pick like that. Former Speaker Jace Bulger, who has since he left the legislature 10 years ago, worked for Dick and Betsy DeVos, is much as the grassroots. You got to remember, Tudor Dixon won the primary in pretty sizable fashion over second place Kevin Rinke, but 60%. Three out of five Republican voters voted for somebody else, and many of those people were very fervent in their support for their candidate and their opposition to Tudor Dixon because of Betsy DeVos's support. They're not going to take DeVos endorsed Tudor Dixon and DeVos employee Jace Bulger. So I think that the navigating behind the scenes to get a candidate who's going to be palatable to the convention delegates is much more difficult than is being led on. The rules that the Republicans have that there has to be the convention needs to reject the gubernatorial nominee's choice three times before a new name can be an additional name can even be placed in nomination. It might sound like, okay, nobody could overcome that hurdle. They're not going to go through. The Dixon campaign does not want a rejection vote. They want an acclamation. And so there's negotiation and deft statesmanship being done to try to make sure they get the right pick to the, and then to complicate that, there's there are going to be donors and others who still would, I guess, fall on the same. They get up on the same side of the bed in the morning, even if they do vote Republican. They're looking at Matt DiPerno and thinking, oh, my God, he's going to be like, you know, a toxic, you know, waste dump when it comes to our electoral chances for attorney general. We've got to get somebody else on the ticket. That's nearly impossible. So when from the party perspective, and you've been there, you want that August nominating convention to be a celebration, to be smooth, to be this, everybody comes out of it united and ready to take on the opposing party in the fall. You don't want it to be, you know, hand-to-hand combat trying to get people, you know, a lieutenant governor nominee across the finish line, an attorney general nominee, a damaged attorney general nominee across the finish line. You don't want the kind of strife that the Republicans are looking at. Meanwhile, the Democratic convention it's going to be boring as all get out. There's no controversy. There's no challenges. There's the only thing they're doing is looking at these Republicans and thinking, you know, keep at it, keep fighting amongst yourselves. The longer the Republicans do that, the better off it's going to be for Team Democrats in Michigan.
Yeah, you know, I think they should sing Kumbaya, Jeff, but I think the hymn that's going to come out of the Republican Convention is Onward Christian Soldiers Marching As to War. I think that's more appropriate. No disrespect intended. That's a theme from my religious faith, the Lutheran faith. That's why I'm familiar with it. But, you know, it's a war theme. And I think that's exactly what we're going to see out of the Republican Convention. You know, all of this has really gotten Tudor Dixon, I think, off message, Jeff, right? I mean, this is the time where she should be pivoting to the general election, and she's trying. I mean, you see what she's been saying and so forth. But between the, I'll just call it the raid, the search at Mar-a-Lago, and now this news about DiPerno and the DiPerno 9 being under criminal investigation, Christina Caramo is now tweeting again about how the election was stolen. All of that is a huge distraction and is keeping their gubernatorial candidate from getting the attention she desperately needs for her general election message. Meanwhile, the Democrats, particularly the DGA, are attacking her already on her extremism on abortion, while the governor stays above the fray and is running ads about her achievements and what she's done and so forth. So again, you know, no predictions. There's no guarantees for November, but the Republicans are having a bad August. Jeff, would you agree?
I would definitely agree. And I would say, you know, again, to, you know, reporters out there who are covering the gubernatorial campaign in Michigan, what Tudor Dixon has done since winning the primary last Tuesday is almost precisely the opposite of what somebody trying to pivot and appeal to a broader general election electorate would normally do. That she got right on a plane and went to the authoritarian CPAC convention where Viktor Orban was giving his, you know, rise of fascism speech, and you know the Republican Party was cheering that along with Tudor Dixon. She then left Dallas and the CPAC convention and went to Wisconsin, where she appeared with Donald Trump in support of his endorsed candidate, his election denier candidate in Wisconsin. On her way back to Michigan, she stopped and made a appearance there, and so she has is She's doubling down on the extreme MAGA election denying extreme position on abortion, the no exception for rape or incest. That is a historic departure from past Republican nominees. And so, you know, there's this effort by some in the Republican Party to kind of paint Tudor Dixon as the candidate who bridges the MAGA and the establishment world. There's no sign in reality that she has any desire to be anywhere other than with Donald Trump and the MAGA world.
The conversation continues with Congressman Dan Kildee after these messages on A Republic, If You Can Keep It.
Epic MRA is pleased to be a sponsor of this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm whose principals have more than four decades of experience measuring public opinion on federal, state, and local issues, from who's ahead in a race for governor or Congress to local support for a proposed zoning change.
Our clients include media outlets, school districts, state agencies, local governments, and membership organizations across the state. Whether it's measuring voter opinions about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation enjoys public support, Epic MRA has been Michigan's premier go-to pollster for 30 years.
Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
When candidates and government leaders need the facts about their voters, they turn to practical political consulting.
PPC has served political candidates, organizations, campaigns, and businesses for more than 45 years. They work with savvy campaigns to provide the best voter lists available in Michigan, as well as campaign consulting, graphic design, and polling at competitive prices.
Over their storied history, PPC has worked with thousands of campaigns, providing them with, as the New York Times once said, quote, the best lists possible in this competitive state, along with unique and individualized strategy.
They've worked with small campaigns for rural school board, all the way up to occupants of the White House. They are also renowned for their work with ballot initiatives, both for challenges and protections.
Find out more. Go to www.practicalpoliticalconsulting.com or call 517-351-5105.
Show your support for preserving our republic at the A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
We're joined this week by Michigan senior Democrat in Congress, Flint's Dan Kildee. As chief deputy whip, part of the Democratic leadership team in Congress, he acts as an important liaison among members of Congress and the leadership to build support for Democratic priorities and legislation. Congressman Kildee serves on three committees, including the Ways and Means Committee, the Budget Committee, and the Science, Space, and Technology Committee.
Before being elected to Congress, Congressman Kildee co-founded and served as the president of the Center for Community Progress, a national nonprofit organization focused on urban land reform and revitalization. He also founded Michigan's first land bank, the Genesee County Land Bank, which is responsible for tens of millions of dollars in redevelopment in Flint and has served as a model for such land banks around the state. Previously, Congressman Kildee served as the Genesee County Treasurer, on the Genesee County Board of Commissioners, and on the Flint Board of Education, where I believe he was one of their youngest members ever. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the podcast my longtime friend, Dan Kildee. Well, welcome, Congressman Dan Kildee, back to the podcast. Great to have you with us. I must say, Dan, over the last several months, I've told people how prescient you were in predicting that some of your Republican colleagues will get caught up in the January 6th investigation. We're not here to talk about that tonight, but you said it here first.
Yeah.
You thought that that's exactly what would happen.
For sure.
What we'd like to focus on, though, is just the tremendous outpouring of federal legislation in the last few months. You were right in the middle of it. By the way, congratulations.
Thank you.
In your role as whip. You know, we know you are integral in making sure all those votes are in order. But let's talk about, for example, let's talk about the CHIPS Act and the impact it's going to have on Michigan. I mean, I know for you, for example, Hemlock Semiconductors in your district.
For sure.
And I bet you there's thousands of autos sitting at the Flint Metal Center that can't be finished because they don't have chips.
That's right.
So what's the CHIPS Act going to do for us here in Michigan?
Well, it will make a difference, especially in the long term. And it allows us through direct investment and through tax incentives to reestablish the manufacturing capacity for something that we invented. Here, we invented the microchip here in the United States. And just like a lot of things over the decades, we allowed our inventions to be commercialized offshore, in places where, where labor costs are cheap, environmental regulations are negligent, and often where state-sponsored ownership makes a difference in terms of our ability to compete. So we're dealing with that both by enforcing existing trade law. I've been working on that, but especially by just having a better offense. And that is having an industrial policy, investing in manufacturing, but particularly investing in those aspects of our manufacturing supply chain that are absolutely critical to our future. And chips, it's not just autos, but it's really big for autos. But just about the entire range of consumer products that has any kind of, you know, electronic moving part now requires a microchip. Now, this will be especially true as we transition to electric vehicles because they require significantly more of these precious microchips. So what this will mean, to answer your question more directly, is that we'll have control of our own destiny by being able to produce in these fabs, these microchip production facilities, the essential elements of a whole range of consumer products, which argues for those products to be manufactured right here in the United States as well. So it's a, you know, it's kind of interesting. What is it fundamentally? It's an industrial policy. It's actually having a policy that says we're going to support American manufacturing. And we haven't had that for a long, long time.
You know, we also had last week the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, finally. That's a major, major accomplishment. Maybe you could fill our listeners into some of the behind-the-scenes goings-on. I know that there was so much focus on, in the Senate on Senator Manchin and Sinema, but there was a lot of other moving parts and a lot of other people who were involved and should get credit for passage of this legislation.
There really was. There was a lot of negotiation going on behind the scenes. I talked to Senator Stabenow and Senator Peters quite a bit. I spoke with the speaker on some of the specific elements that I have written that were included in the legislation. You know, and I will admit, you know, to having had some frustration with Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema, I will say I'm glad we didn't burn those bridges. You know, we had our differences, but we didn't burn those bridges. And we were able to get to a place where we could come to an understanding. It means moving forward with electric vehicles, a really significant priority. The question about electric vehicles is not whether mobility is moving to electrification. It's whether we're going to build them or somebody else is. And this helps answer that question. But it has my solar bill in it that I did with Senator Ossoff and Senator Warnock. I had the House version of the bill that invests through the tax code in the entire supply chain of solar production, including that solar grade polysilicon that is made, you know, at least in my case, made right in Saginaw County at Hemlock Semiconductor. But it includes other really important things like premium supports, the extension of additional premium supports for people who purchase their healthcare through the ACA, through the exchange. A $2,000 cap on out-of-pocket medical expenses for Medicare recipients. For the first time ever, being able to negotiate the price of prescription drugs and not being prohibited by what was a Republican move to support the big pharma. Yeah, there are some disappointments in it. I wrote the legislation to cap out-of-pocket costs for insulin at $35. The Republicans, because they could, stripped out the provisions that related to private insurance, left intact the provisions that we wrote as it relates to Medicare. So it's got a lot of great stuff in it. It also provides a bit of a roadmap for what the next pieces need to be come January, when hopefully we have the ability to complete this agenda.
Also, too, now we're starting to see the effects of the Infrastructure Act that you passed a few months ago. Can you tell us about what impact that's having in Michigan as the grant money and the programs start to now roll out from the federal government? What's going on there, Dan?
People are seeing it. I mean, the projects that were ready to go are moving forward, and we're seeing a lot of that. Bridge repair being a really important one. Water and sewer line repair and construction. The conventional stuff that we see, like road construction, you know, there's two sides to that. People see the orange barrels and they complain, but the truth of the matter is what that means is people working at good paying jobs, building better infrastructure, which makes our economy stronger. So we're actually seeing the physical evidence of that. The pieces of it that we will begin to see as well are in those communities where they were prepared to move forward on expanding broadband. We're going to see some of those digital deserts being filled in. That's going to take a little more time, but there are some that we'll be seeing right away. I went out and saw some microfiber being put in. This is going to make a big difference in terms of connecting people to the economy. And it has a long tail to it. We're starting now, but this is a series of projects that's going to go on for years. And it's one of the reasons that I think some of us are, are a little more bullish on the economy once we get through the impact of the pandemic. We have an economy that's poised to grow, to continue to grow. We see it already in the jobs numbers that were just reported, over 500,000 new jobs created in the month of July. So we're poised to do a lot. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that Democrats and President Biden, well, we all got together and we're passing really significant bills that would be, heck, this would be a good first term. And if you look at past presidencies, this would be a good tenure. If you think about the American Rescue Plan, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, the CHIPS Act, Inflation Reduction Act, the infrastructure, the health care, the energy investments that we're making are really unprecedented. And it's something that we obviously we're not getting the credit we ought to get for it, but we got to get out there and take the credit. We got to explain to people what we've done. We can't expect them to know it.
I think we know historically the way the winds are blowing in an election is usually determined before August of an election year. You kind of get a feel for which way the wind is going to go. But I think one thing we've learned in these last few years is that the whatever has been kind of the norm or the historic measure, we can set those things aside. We're in unprecedented times, and we have a very fluid kind of macro political environment. I think before the Dobbs decision overturning Roe, the whole prospect of a good Republican year was real at the time. You know, that's what you look at polls, they're a snapshot in time. And if the election would have been held last spring, the Republicans would have had a lot better, time than I think they would have if the election were held today. Now, we still have 3 months to go, but I think for those folks who are either Democrats or, like me, concerned about pro-democracy forces winning or the anti-democracy forces, the Republican Party losing, I think that we can find a lot of things to be heartened about. I mean, I have to imagine that the attitude within the House Democratic Conference is much more confident now than it was, say, 3 months ago. I know we've been talking about policy, but maybe put on a political hat here a little bit and tell us about the national perspective and in the, you know, is the DCCC and looking at not only races in Michigan, but across the country and the ability to hold on to that majority and those chairmanships that you have on the Democratic side.
Yeah, I think we're, look, 3 months ago, I was far more pessimistic than I am now. We hadn't done a lot of this really important legislative work, and Dobbs hadn't occurred. Both have won in a really dramatic way, and I say that about Dobbs and the overturning of the Roe protections being a potentially dramatic impact on this race, because you have generations, particularly generations of women, who have been able to take for granted that protection and then vote on other issues that they might feel, you know, are also important to them. That fundamental question is back on the ballot in Michigan, literally on the ballot, but even proverbially, it's on the ballot, because if the Republicans are in charge of the House and the Senate, they're going to pass a national ban on abortion. My opponent has said no exceptions for rape, no exceptions for incest, no exceptions for the health of the mother. You know, that is not a defensible position in the 21st century. So that's one piece of it. And then the work that we've done more recently, I think both of those sit nicely in a backdrop where Democrats look, we are the party that has shown its ability to compromise in the name of progress. They are the party that is engaged in chaos in the name of power. And if we can present that dichotomy, that's that elections are always about choices. And if what we see on the other side, Scott Perry having his telephone seized by the FBI, Donald Trump having his Mar-a-Lago home raided, a party leadership like Kevin McCarthy so willing to embrace the craziest anti-democratic theories, and at the same time blocking people from having a $35 cap on prescription drugs in the name of their power. We present that version of a party against ours, where we were willing to compromise among ourselves to get some progress made. We're the adults in the room, and we're going to protect women's reproductive freedom. I mean, that's a pretty stark choice.
Yeah, Dan, I also think, and I welcome your thoughts on this, that the January 6th committee has done a very good job in terms of not only what they found, but how they're presenting their findings to the public. And I think that's been pretty riveting, and I think it's been very educational experience for a lot of Americans. What are your thoughts on that?
I've been, and I almost hate to admit to say it this way, but is it okay to say I've been pleasantly surprised? Because, I mean, I've just seen congressional committees try to communicate a message in, you know, 5-minute segments going back and forth. And I just think they did a masterful job of using almost entirely Trump appointees or Republican witnesses to tell their story in a way that depicted, I think, in much, much clearer terms than normally we would be able to see a committee depict a really clear view of what happened, you know, and I think there's more to come too. And you know, these are folks that are friends of mine, Adam Schiff, you know, I think met Adam recently, he's a friend of mine, Pete Aguilar, several others that are working on this. Benny Thompson, I think, has done an incredible job, because they understand something that a lot of Democrats don't always get, and that is people understand the power of story. You can't just inundate them with a bunch of data. People understand the arc of a story. And what they saw was a story of a party and a presidency that had lost its soul in the name of power and were willing to look the other way as a violent mob because they were chanting that leader's name, can be treated the way they were. I mean, and even now, you saw the CPAC conference, the conservative conference, you know, celebrating the people who tried to kill me, who came to the Capitol with the intent to kill us. And I take it personally, because, as you know, I was one of those people that were trapped in the Capitol when the place was evacuated. It's I think they did a really good job, and it is part of the story that is being weaved about the differences between the two parties. The Republicans have embraced these anti-democratic voices, and we're holding them to account.
Yeah, I really think, you know, as we look here with
you know, 90 days to go until the election, you have such a stark choice in a state like Michigan with the top of the Republican ticket from their gubernatorial nominee, their Secretary of State nominee, and the Attorney General nominee, who's has a legal cloud hanging over him. You have people who have embraced the most extreme radical positions far outside the historic mainstream of the Republican Party on issues like abortion, on the 2020 election. You know, that seems to be an ante on the table before you even get dealt into the game. You have to say that the 2020 election was fraudulent, it was stolen, and you have to get out there and be willing to say that. And so it seems like with the incumbents, Democrats that are running in Michigan on at the state level, and folks like you on the federal level are all seem to be pulling in the same direction, and have such a good contrast to present to this crazy crop of Republican candidates, be at the top of the ticket, statewide officials, or folks like Tom Barrett or Paul Young or John James or John Gibbs, you know, running in the who defeated Pete Meyer last week. You know, there's just such a clear contrast. And you say elections are about choices. And I really think this has become a choice election far more than a referendum on the party in power in the White House, as some midterms have historically been.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think because there's two aspects of this that need to be communicated, I think, simultaneously. One is the obsession with power that the other side has. Power obsessed to the point that they're willing to put forward these deranged voices as their spokespeople, because they go along with the power grab. They go along with that agenda. But then I think even perhaps more importantly is to communicate what these Republicans would intend to do with that power. And that, I think, is where those kitchen table issues come right into focus. What they intend to do with that power is to take away the right that women have had for half a century to make decisions about their own bodies, about their own healthcare, about their own choices, even when, as a victim of rape or incest, they are perhaps even as a minor child, you know, the 10-year-old from Ohio is a case study. So it's the thirst and drunken demand for power that we see from these deranged Republicans, and what we know they intend to do with that power, which I think create a real toxic mix that we have to communicate.
There's one aspect of this I just got to ask you about. A little bit of background for our listeners. There's a federal law called the Electoral Count Act, which governs how electoral college votes are counted by the Congress. And this was an act that Trump and his henchmen tried to take advantage of, part of the pressure campaign on Pence, for example, not to count the votes and so forth. And it's such an old act. I think it's well over a century old and full of ambiguous language. And I'm encouraged, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on, there appear to be bipartisan efforts to fix that act. So at least in 2024, it can't be used by a Trump to do what he tried to do in 2020. Any prognosis on that?
Yeah, I think we have a chance to get that done. It's hard to say with Republicans in the House, as slim as our margins are, I still think we could probably do something with this in the House. The Senate, because of their rules, is a little more problematic. I'm a strong opponent of the Senate rules that allow a 60-vote threshold to be in place. It's a throwback to Jim Crow. But, you know, the Electoral Count Act, which was enacted in 1887 after the 1880 and 1884 elections, needs to be modified, obviously, to make sure that what was implied by the Electoral Count Act in 87 was that this was a ministerial function, but that what Trump tried to do is turn it into an opportunity for people to exercise their own whims or judgment. That needs to be corrected. I support it. Don't get me wrong. I think the better solution is to eliminate the Electoral College and go with a popular vote selection for president of the United States. That's my serious preference. The problem with both is that in neither case do they negate what the Republican agenda is to try to constrain access to the ballot in the 50 states. And we have to fight that the way I think to a great extent successfully have fought it here in Michigan, You know, we've had some progress. We've been able to get some improvements. We got to hold on to those. But we know that what we're seeing in other states is really concerning in terms of ballot access or access to voting access.
Yeah, so hopefully we're in a position next year with perhaps the leadership of Senator Peters, who's heading up the campaign arm in the Senate, where we've actually got the votes to get rid of the filibuster, right? Yep. That would just take a simple rules change, right? Yeah.
We need a couple of more Democratic senators. And I do disagree with certainly the Republicans, but absolutely the Democrats, who still hold on to the special privileges that the Senate has afforded itself. And occasionally I'll mention rhetorically to some of my Senate colleagues that, you know, maybe in the House we're going to come up with a 60% threshold. How would you like that? I mean, there's nothing about the framework of our Constitution that implies that there should be a supermajority for anything other than what the Constitution explicitly required a supermajority to do, like the impeachment of a president or, you know, a treaty ratification. I mean, we have a hard enough time managing the distortion of the body politic that is present in the U.S. Senate when the two senators from Wyoming have the same political weight as the two senators from California. But we don't need the additional hurdle in place. And I think if Gary is successful, and I think we've got a good shot in Ohio, I think we have a shot, obviously, in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. I feel good about where we are in Georgia with Senator Warnock. I feel good about where we are with Mark Kelly. We got to finish those elections. But if we do that, we could end up with 52 Democratic senators. The biggest change there would be being able to eliminate the filibuster. And then think about the Voting Rights Act. Think about all the pieces of legislation that the House has sent over the Senate to sit gathering dust on someone's desk could go to the president's desk and be signed into law. That would be fantastic. I mean, my insulin bill, which is I know it's a small bill, but it's big for the people that it affects. That could be law. And so to me, that's Gary's got a really important job. We got to hold the House too, but that would make a huge difference if we could get to 52 in the Senate.
Yeah, and you wouldn't have to use, which I think you've been, not you, but the Senate has been very creative about the reconciliation process. You wouldn't have to try to cram these things through the reconciliation process, just straight out pass them as legislation.
And that's how they were able to strip out the provisions on the insulin price cap was because we were using reconciliation. And basically, if the determination is that it's more policy than economic, then you know, it can't go through reconciliation.
Right. Yeah, it would be nice if we have a functioning Senate in 2023 that's not where Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, and the Senate parliamentarian aren't the three most powerful people in the country.
Yeah,
that's certainly where we are now.
It's pretty frustrating.
Well, I think we are nearing the end of our time, and we want to, you know, thank Congressman Dan Kildee. Dan, you know, people listening, where do they find you online? How do they donate to your campaign online? You know, let's make sure to, you know, leave them with that information.
Yeah, anybody who wants to be a part of our effort, you just go to dankildee.com, and you get the whole the whole panoply of ways to get plugged in. Mark knows this because we've worked together for so long. I never take any election for granted, but I've never worked harder than I have in this one. The stakes are so high. And I'll tell you this, it's not about me. I mean, it's not like my life depends on being a member of Congress, but our country depends on Democrats retaining control. My congressional district, if you took all 435 seats and put them on a political spectrum, what you would find is that my district is the median district in terms of partisanship. There are 217 more Democratic seats. There are 217 more Republican seats to my right and to my left. So in theory, and only in theory, but this is partly in practice, if we can win my seat, which I'm committed to do, arguably, mine is the 218th seat in the United States Congress, you know, so no pressure here. But we have to win my seat if we're going to retain control of the House.
Well, and I think that pointing that out, in order, you have to appeal to a broad spectrum of people across the district, you know, not just partisan Democrats. You have to appeal to those centrist voters, those moderate Republicans. And you know, you're somebody who gets this. You've succeeded in this game for a long time. You've got an opponent, Paul Young, who's, you know, district shopping. He ran against Alyssa Slotkin in a completely different district 2 years ago, seems completely oblivious to the fact that, you know, primary voters aren't where elections are determined, which is, I think, great for I think he's the kind of candidate, kind of Republican who represents a threat to democracy. And you're the kind of Democrat who appeals to pro-democracy Americans, not just to Democrats. And so I thank you for the work you're doing.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. I'm committed to getting this done. You know, Democrats, Republicans, and independents work in factories and will benefit from the jobs we're creating. Democrats, Republicans, and independents need insulin to stay alive, need, you know, all the things we've done are not really partisan. They're about people. It's people over politics. And if we can get that message across, I think we're going to be fine.
Well, thanks again, Dan, and good luck as you vote this week on the Inflation Reduction Act. I'm sure you whipped all the votes and all the Democrats are going to be in line, and that'll cross the president's desk, and there'll be a big signing ceremony in the near future.
I'm looking forward to that. Absolutely. Thank you both. Thank you all. Appreciate it.
This week's discussion has really flown by, and we thank Congressman Dan Kildee for his update on the incredible impact we see in Michigan as a result of the CHIPS Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, and all of the federal legislation that we've seen in the last several months.
We'll be back next week with who knows what, other than we know it will be unexpected and probably explosive.
As always, we welcome your questions, comments, and suggestions. Email us at arepublicpodcast@gmail.com.
If the Republic is still standing, we'll return in a week. I'm Jeff Timmer.
And I'm Mark Brewer. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on all major podcast sites. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.